Easy, child, you come along o' me. And you go with him in a boat out across the lake into the mist. What happens there, no one knows. No one's ever come back.
The woman told a child to call the deaths in, and he scampered to the door and spoke to them. Will and Lyra watched in wonder, and the Gallivespians drew closer together as the deaths, one for each of the family, came in through the door. Pale, unremarkable figures in shabby clothes, just drab and quiet and dull.
"These are your deaths,"
said Tialis.
"Indeed, sir."
"Do you know when they'll tell you it's time to go?"
"No, but you know they're close by, and that's a comfort."
Tialis said nothing, but it was clear that he felt it would be anything but a comfort. The deaths stood politely along the wall, and it was strange to see how little space they took up, and to find how little notice they attracted. Lyra and Will soon found themselves ignoring them altogether, though Will thought, "Those men I killed, their deaths were close beside them all the time. They didn't know, and I didn't know." The woman, Martha, dished the stew onto chipped enamel plates and put some in a bowl for the deaths to pass among themselves. They didn't eat, but the good smell kept them content. Presently all the family and their guests were eating hungrily, and Peter asked the children where they'd come from and what their world was like.
"I'll tell you all about it," said Lyra.
As she said that, as she took charge, part of her felt a little stream of pleasure rising upwards in her breast like the bubbles in champagne. And she knew Will was watching, and she was happy that he could see her doing what she was best at, doing it for him and for all of them. She started by telling about her parents. They were a duke and duchess, very important and wealthy, who had been cheated out of their estate by a political enemy and thrown into prison. But they managed to escape by climbing down a rope with the baby Lyra in her father's arms, and they regained the family fortune, only to be attacked and murdered by outlaws. Lyra would have been killed as well, and roasted and eaten, had not Will rescued her just in time and taken her back to the wolves, in the forest where he was being brought up as one of them. He had fallen overboard as a baby from the side of his father's ship and been washed up on a desolate shore, where a female wolf had suckled him and kept him alive. The people ate up this nonsense with placid credulity, and even the deaths crowded close to listen, perching on the bench or lying on the floor close by, gazing at her with their mild and courteous faces as she spun out the tale of her life with Will in the forest. He and Lyra stayed with the wolves for a while, and then moved to Oxford to work in the kitchens of Jordan College. There they met Roger, and when Jordan was attacked by the brick burners who lived in the clay beds, they had to escape in a hurry. So she and Will and Roger captured an Egyptian narrow boat and sailed it all the way down the Thames, nearly getting caught in Abingdon Lock. And then they'd been sunk by the Wapping pirates and had to swim for safety to a three-masted clipper just setting off for Hangzhou and Cathay to trade for tea. And on the clipper they'd met the Gallivespians, who were strangers from the moon, blown down to the earth by a fierce gale out of the Milky Way. They'd taken refuge in the crow's nest, and she and Will and Roger used to take turns going up there to see them. Only one day Roger lost his footing and plunged down into Davy Jones's locker. They tried to persuade the captain to turn the ship around and look for him, but he was a hard, fierce man, only interested in the profit he'd make by getting to Cathay quickly, and he clapped them in irons. But the Gallivespians brought them a file, and so on. From time to time she'd turn to Will or the spies for confirmation, and Salmakia would add a detail or two, or Will would nod, and the story wound itself up to the point where the children and their friends from the moon had to find their way to the land of the dead in order to learn, from her parents, the secret of where the family fortune had been buried.
"And if we knew our deaths in our land, like you do here, it would be easier, probably. But I think we're really lucky to find our way here, so's we could get your advice. And thank you very much for being so kind and listening, and for giving us this meal. It was really nice. But what we need now, you see, or in the morning maybe, is we need to find a way out across the water, where the dead people go, and see if we can get there too. Is there any boats we could sort of hire?"
They looked doubtful. The children, flushed with tiredness, looked with sleepy eyes from one grown-up to the other, but no one could suggest where they could find a boat. Then came a voice that hadn't spoken before. From the depths of the bedclothes in the corner came a dry, cracked, nasal tone. Not a woman's voice. Not a living voice. It was the voice of the grandmother's death.
The only way you'll cross the lake and go to the land of the dead,
he said, and he was leaning up on his elbow, pointing with a skinny finger at Lyra,
is with your own deaths. You must call up your own deaths. I have heard of people like you who keep their deaths at bay. You don't like them, and out of courtesy they stay out of sight. But they're not far off. Whenever you turn your head, your deaths dodge behind you. Wherever you look, they hide. They can hide in a teacup, or in a dewdrop, or in a breath of wind. Not like me and old Magda here,
he said, and he pinched her withered cheek, and she pushed his hand away.
We live together in kindness and friendship. That's the answer. That's it. That's what you've got to do. Say welcome. Make friends. Be kind. Invite your deaths to come close to you and see what you can get them to agree to.
His words fell into Lyra's mind like heavy stones. And Will, too, felt the deadly weight of them.
How should we do that?
You've only got to wish for it. And the thing is done.
Wait,
said Tialis. Every eye turned to him, and those deaths lying on the floor sat up to turn their blank, mild faces to his tiny, passionate one. He was standing close by Salmakia, his hand on her shoulder. Lyra could see what he was thinking. He was going to say that this had gone too far. They must turn back. They were taking this foolishness to irresponsible lengths. So she stepped in.
Excuse me,
she said to the man, Peter.
But me and our friend the Chevalier, we've got to go outside for a minute, because he needs to talk to his friends in the moon through my special instrument. We won't be long.
And she picked him up carefully, avoiding his spurs, and took him outside into the dark, where a loose piece of corrugated iron roofing was banging in the cold wind with a melancholy sound.
You must stop,
he said, as she set him on an upturned oil drum, in the feeble light of one of those anbaric bulbs that swung on its cable overhead.
This is far enough. No more.
But we made an agreement.
No, no, not to these lengths.
All right, leave us. You fly on back. Will can cut a window into your world or any world you like, and you can fly through and be safe. That's all right. We don't mind.
Do you realize what you're doing?
Yes.
You don't. You're a thoughtless, irresponsible, lying child. Fantasy comes so easily to you that your whole nature is riddled with dishonesty. And you don't even admit the truth when it stares you in the face. Well, if you can't see it, I'll tell you plainly. You cannot, you must not risk your death. You must come back with us now. I'll call Lord Asriel, and we can be safe in the fortress in hours.
Lyra felt a great sob of rage building up in her chest, and stamped her foot, unable to keep still.
You don't know. You just don't know what I got in my head or my heart, do you? I don't know if you people ever have children. Maybe you lay eggs or something. I wouldn't be surprised. Because you're not kind, you're not generous, you're not considerate. You're not cruel, even. That would be better, if you were cruel. Because it'd mean you took us serious. You didn't just go along with us when it suited you. Oh, I can't trust you at all now. You said you'd help, and we'd do it together. And now you want to stop us. You're the dishonest one, Tialis.
I wouldn't let a child of my own speak to me in the insolent, high-handed way you're speaking, Lyra. Why, I haven't punished you before.
Then go ahead. Punish me since you can. Take your bloody spurs and dig them in hard. Go on. Here's my hand. Do it. You've got no idea what's in my heart, you proud, selfish creature. You've got no notion how I feel sad and wicked and sorry about my friend Roger. You kill people just like that.
She snapped her finger.
They don't matter to you. But it's a torment and a sorrow to me that I never said goodbye to him. And I want to say sorry and make it as good as I can. You'd never understand that, for all your pride, for all your grown-up cleverness. And if I have to die to do what's proper, then I will, and be happy while I do. I've seen worse than that. So if you want to kill me, you hard man, you strong man, you poison bearer, you chevalier, you do it. Go on, kill me. Then me and Roger can play in the land of the dead forever, and laugh at you, you pitiful thing.
What Tialis might have done then wasn't hard to see, for he was ablaze from head to foot with a passionate anger, shaking with it. But he didn't have time to move before a voice spoke behind Lyra, and they both felt a chill fall over them. Lyra turned around, knowing what she'd see and dreading it despite her bravado. The Death stood very close, smiling kindly, his face exactly like those of all the others she'd seen. But this was hers, her very own Death. And Pantalaimon at her breast howled and shivered, and his ermine shape flowed up around her neck and tried to push her away from the Death. But by doing that, he only pushed himself closer, and realizing it, he shrank back towards her again, to her warm throat and the strong pulse of her heart. Lyra clutched him to her and faced the Death directly. She couldn't remember what he'd said, and out of the corner of her eye, she could see Tialis quickly preparing the lodestone resonator, busy.
You're my Death, ain't you?
Yes, my dear.
You ain't gonna take me yet, are you?
You wanted me. I am always here.
Yes, but I did, yes. But I want to go to the land of the dead, that's true. But not to die. I don't want to die. I love being alive. And I love my demon, and demons don't go down there, do they? I've seen them vanish and just go out like candles when people die. Do they have demons in the land of the dead?
No. Your demon vanishes into the air, and you vanish under the ground.
Then I want to take my demon with me when I go to the land of the dead, and I want to come back again. Has it ever been known for people to do that?
Not for many, many ages. Eventually, child, you will come to the land of the dead with no effort, no risk, a safe, calm journey in the company of your own Death. Your special, devoted friend, who's been beside you every moment of your life, who knows you better than yourself.
But Pantalaimon is my special and devoted friend. I don't know you, Death. I know Pan, and I love Pan. And if he ever... if we ever...
The Death was nodding. He seemed interested and kindly, but she couldn't for a moment forget what he was, her very own Death, and so close.
I know it'll be an effort to go on now, and dangerous. But I want to, Death. I do truly. And so does Will. We both had people taken away too soon. And we need to make amends. At least I do.
Everyone wishes they could speak again to those who've gone to the land of the dead. Why should there be an exception for you?
Because...
she began, lying...
because there's something I've got to do there. Not just seeing my friend Roger. Something else. It was a task put on me by an angel. And no one else can do it, only me. It's too important to wait till I die in the natural way. It's got to be done now. See, the angel commanded me. That's why we came here, me and Will. We got to.
Behind her, Tialis put away his instrument and sat watching the child plead with her own Death to be taken where no one should go. The Death scratched his head and held up his hands. But nothing could stop Lyra's words, nothing could deflect her desire, not even fear. She'd seen worse than Death, she claimed. And she had, too. So eventually her Death said,
"If nothing can put you off, then all I can say is, come with me and I will take you there, into the land of the dead. I'll be your guide. I can show you the way in, but as for getting out again, you'll have to manage by yourself."
"And my friends? My friend Will and the others?"
"Lyra,"
said Tialis,
"against every instinct we'll go with you. I was angry with you a minute ago, but you make it hard."
Lyra knew that this was a time to conciliate, and she was happy to do that, having got her way.
"Yes, I am sorry, Tialis, but if you hadn't got angry, we'd never have found this gentleman to guide us. So I'm glad you were here. You and the lady. I'm really grateful to you for being with us."
So Lyra persuaded her own Death to guide her and the others into the land where Roger had gone, and Will's father, and Tony Makarios, and so many others. And her Death told her to go down to the jetty when the first light came to the sky, and prepare to leave. But Pantalaimon was trembling and shivering, and nothing Lyra could do could soothe him into stillness, or quiet the soft little moan he couldn't help uttering. So her sleep was broken and shallow, on the floor of the shack with all the other sleepers, and her death sat watchfully beside her. Chapter 20. Climbing.
I gained it so, by climbing slow, by catching at the twigs that grow between the bliss and me. Emily Dickinson.
The Mulefa made many kinds of rope and cord, and Mary Malone spent a morning inspecting and testing the ones Atal's family had in their stores before choosing what she wanted. The principle of twisting and winding hadn't caught on in their world, so all the cords and ropes were braided. But they were strong and flexible, and Mary soon found exactly the sort she wanted.
"What are you doing?"
said Atal. The Mulefa had no term for climb, so Mary had to do a lot of gesturing and roundabout explaining. Atal was horrified.
"To go into the high part of the trees?
I must see what is happening,"
Mary explained.
"Now, you can help me prepare the rope."
Once in California, Mary had met a mathematician who spent every weekend climbing among the trees. Mary had done a little rock climbing, and she'd listened avidly as he had talked about the techniques and equipment. She decided to try it herself as soon as she had the chance. Of course, she'd never expected to be climbing trees in another universe, and climbing solo didn't greatly appeal either, but there was no choice about that. What she could do was make it as safe as possible beforehand. She took a coil long enough to reach over one of the branches of a high tree and back down to the ground, and strong enough to bear several times her weight. Then she cut a large number of short pieces of a smaller but very tough cord and made slings with them, short loops tied with a fisherman's knot, which could make hand and footholds when she tied them to the main line. Then there was the problem of getting the rope over the branch in the first place. An hour or two's experimenting with some fine tough cord and a length of springy branch produced a bow. The Swiss Army knife cut some arrows with stiff leaves in place of feathers to stabilize them in flight, and finally, after a day's work, Mary was ready to begin. But the sun was setting and her hands were tired, and she ate and slept, preoccupied, while the Mulefa discussed her endlessly in their quiet, musical whispers. First thing in the morning, she set off to shoot an arrow over a branch. Some of the Mulefa gathered to watch, anxious for her safety. Climbing was so alien to creatures with wheels that the very thought of it horrified them. Privately, Mary knew how they felt. She swallowed her nervousness and tied an end of the thinnest, lightest line to one of her arrows and sent it flying upwards from the bow. She lost the first arrow. It stuck in the bark part way up and wouldn't come out. She lost the second because, although it did clear the branch, it didn't fall far enough to reach the ground on the other side, and pulling it back she caught it and snapped it. The long line fell back attached to the broken shaft, and she tried again with the third and last, and this time it worked. Pulling carefully and steadily so as not to snag the line and break it, she hauled the prepared rope up and over until both ends were on the ground. Then she tied them both securely to a massive buttress of one of the roots, as thick around as her own hips, so it should be fairly solid, she thought. It had better be. What she couldn't tell from the ground, of course, was what kind of branch the whole thing, including her, would be depending on. Unlike climbing on rock, where you could fasten the rope to pitons on the cliff face every few yards so you never had far to fall, this business involved one very long free length of rope, and one very long fall if anything went wrong. To make herself a little more secure, she braided together three small ropes into a harness, and passed it around both hanging ends of the main rope with a loose knot that she could tighten the moment she began to slip. Mary put her foot in the first sling and began to climb. She reached the canopy in less time than she'd anticipated. The climbing was straightforward, the rope was kindly on her hands, and although she hadn't wanted to think about the problem of getting on top of the first branch, she found that the deep fissures in the bark helped her to get a solid purchase and feel secure. In fact, only 15 minutes after she'd left the ground, she was standing on the first branch and planning her route to the next. She had brought two more coils of rope with her, intending to make a web of fixed lines to serve in place of the pitons and anchors and friends, another hardware she relied on when climbing a rock face. Tying them in place took her some minutes more, and once she'd secured herself, she chose what looked like the most promising branch, coiled her spare rope again, and set off. After 10 minutes' careful climbing, she found herself right in the thickest part of the canopy. She could reach the long leaves and run them through her hands. She found flower after flower, off-white and absurdly small, each growing the little coin-sized thing that would later become one of those great iron-hard seed pods. She reached a comfortable spot where three branches forked, tied the rope securely, adjusted her harness, and rested. Through the gaps in the leaves she could see the blue sea, clear and sparkling as far as the horizon. And in the other direction over her right shoulder, she could see the succession of low rises in the gold-brown prairie, laced across by the black highways. There was a light breeze, which lifted a faint scent out of the flowers and rustled the stiff leaves, and Mary imagined a huge, dim benevolence holding her up, like a pair of giant hands. As she lay on the fork of the great branches, she felt a kind of bliss she had only felt once before, and that was not when she made her vows as a nun. Eventually she was brought back to her normal state of mind by a cramp in her right ankle, which was resting awkwardly in the crook of the fork. She eased it away and turned her attention to the task, still dizzy from the sense of oceanic gladness that surrounded her. She'd explained to the Mulefa how she had to hold the sap lacquer plates a handspan apart in order to see the thruff, and at once they'd seen the problem and made a short tube of bamboo, fixing the amber-coloured plates at each end like a telescope. This spyglass was tucked in her breast pocket, and she took it out now. When she looked through it, she saw those drifting golden sparkles, the sraf, the shadows, Lyra's dust, like a vast cloud of tiny beings floating through the wind. For the most part, they drifted randomly like dust motes in a shaft of sunlight or molecules in a glass of water. For the most part. But the longer she looked, the more she began to see another kind of motion. Underlying the random drifting was a deeper, slower, universal movement out from the land towards the sea. Well, that was curious. Securing herself to one of her fixed ropes, she crawled out along a horizontal branch, looking closely at all the flower heads she could find. And presently she began to see what was happening. She watched and waited till she was perfectly sure, and then began the careful, lengthy, strenuous process of climbing down. Mary found the Mulefa in a fearful state, having suffered 1,000 anxieties for their friend so far off the ground. Atal was especially relieved and touched her nervously all over with her trunk, uttering gentle whinnies of pleasure to find her safe and carrying her swiftly down to the settlement along with a dozen or so others. As soon as they came over the brow of the hill, the call went out among those in the village, and by the time they reached the speaking ground, the throng was so thick that Mary guessed there were many visitors from elsewhere come to hear what she said. She wished she had better news for them. The old Zalif Satamax mounted the platform and welcomed her warmly, and she responded with all the Mulefa courtesy she could remember. As soon as the greetings were over, she began to speak. Haltingly and with many roundabout phrasings, she said,
"My good friends, I have been into the high canopy of your trees and looked closely at the growing leaves and the young flowers and the seed pods. I could see that there is a current of sraf high in the treetops, and it moves against the wind. The air is moving inland off the sea, but the sraf is moving slowly against it. Can you see that from the ground? Because I could not."
"No," said Satamax. "That is the first we ever heard about that."
"Well, the trees are filtering the sraf as it moves through them, and some of it is attracted to the flowers. I could see it happening. The flowers are turned upwards, and if the sraf were falling straight down, it would enter their petals and fertilize them like pollen from the stars. But the sraf isn't falling down. It's moving out towards the sea. When a flower happens to be facing the land, the sraf can enter it. That's why there are still some seed pods growing. But most of them face upwards, and the sraf just drifts past without entering. The flowers must have evolved like that, because in the past, all the sraf fell straight down. Something has happened to the sraf, not to the trees, and you can only see that current from high up, which is why you never knew about it. So if you want to save the trees and Mulefa life, we must find out why the sraf is doing that. I can't think of a way yet, but I will try."
She saw many of them craning to look upwards at this drift of dust, but from the ground you couldn't see it. She looked through the spyglass herself, but the dense blue of the sky was all she could see. They spoke for a long time, trying to recall any mention of the Sraf wind among their legends and histories, but there was none. All they had ever known was that Sraf came from the stars, as it had always done. Finally, they asked if Mary had any more ideas, and she said,
I need to make more observations. I need to find out whether the wind goes always in that direction, or whether it alters like the air currents during the day and the night. So I need to spend more time in the treetops, and sleep up there, and observe at night. I will need your help to build a platform of some kind, so I can sleep safely. But we do need more observations.
The Mulefa, practical and anxious to find out, offered at once to build her whatever she needed. They knew the techniques of using pulleys and tackle, and presently one suggested a way of lifting Mary easily into the canopy so as to save her the dangerous labor of climbing. Glad to have something to do, they set about gathering materials at once, braiding and tying and lashing spars and ropes and lines under her guidance, and assembling everything she needed for a treetop observation platform. After speaking to the old couple by the olive grove, Father Gomez lost the track. He spent several days searching and inquiring in every direction, but the woman seemed to have vanished completely. He would never have given up, although it was discouraging. The crucifix around his neck and the rifle at his back were twin tokens of his absolute determination to complete the task. But it would have taken him much longer if it hadn't been for a difference in the weather. In the world he was in, it was hot and dry, and he was increasingly thirsty. And seeing a wet patch of rock at the top of a scree, he climbed up to see if there was a spring there. There wasn't, but in the world of the wheel pod trees there had just been a shower of rain. And so it was that he discovered the window, and found where Mary had gone. Chapter 21 The Harpies.
I hate things all fiction. There should always be some foundation of fact. Byron.
Lyra and Will each awoke with a heavy dread. It was like being a condemned prisoner on the morning fixed for the execution. Dialis and Salmakia were attending to their dragonflies, bringing them moths lassoed near the anbaric lamp over the oil drum outside, flies cut from spiderwebs, and water in a tin plate. When she saw the expression on Lyra's face, and the way that Pantalaimon, mouse-formed, was pressing himself close to her breast, the Lady Salmakia left what she was doing to come and speak with her. Will, meanwhile, left the hut to walk about outside.
"You can still decide differently,"
said Salmakia.
"No, we can't. We decided already,"
said Lyra, stubborn and fearful at once.
"And if we don't come back?"
"You don't have to come."
"We're not going to abandon you."
"Then what if you don't come back?"
"We shall have died doing something important."
Lyra was silent. She hadn't really looked at the lady before, but she could see her very clearly now in the smoky light of the naphtha lamp, standing on the table just an arm's length away. Her face was calm and kindly, not beautiful, not pretty, but the very sort of face you would be glad to see if you were ill or unhappy or frightened. Her voice was low and expressive, with a current of laughter and happiness under the clear surface. In all the life she could remember, Lyra had never been read to in bed. No one had told her stories or sung nursery rhymes with her before kissing her and putting out the light. But she suddenly thought now that if ever there was a voice that would lap you in safety and warm you with love, it would be a voice like the Lady Salmakia's. And she felt a wish in her heart to have a child of her own, to lull and soothe and sing to, one day, in a voice like that.
"Well,"
Lyra said, and found her throat choked, so she swallowed and shrugged.
"We'll see,"
said the lady, and turned back. Once they had eaten their thin, dry bread and drunk their bitter tea, which was all the people had to offer them, they thanked their hosts, took their rucksacks, and set off through the shanty town for the lake shore. Lyra looked around for her death, and sure enough, there he was, walking politely a little way ahead. But he didn't want to come closer, though he kept looking back to see if they were following. The day was overhung with a gloomy mist. It was more like dusk than daylight, and wraiths and streamers of the fog rose dismally from puddles in the road, or clung like forlorn lovers to the anbaric cables overhead. They saw no people and few deaths, but the dragonflies skimmed through the damp air, as if they were sewing it all together with invisible threads, and it was a delight to the eyes to watch their bright colours flashing back and forth. Before long they had reached the edge of the settlement and made their way beside a sluggish stream through bare-twigged, scrubby bushes. Occasionally they would hear a harsh croak or a splash as some amphibian was disturbed, but the only creature they saw was a toad as big as Will's foot, which could only flop in a pain-filled sideways heave as if it were horribly injured. It lay across the path, trying to move out of the way and looking at them as if it knew they meant to hurt it.
"It would be merciful to kill it," said Tialis.
"How do you know?"
said Lyra.
"It might still like being alive, in spite of everything."
"If we killed it, we'd be taking it with us,"
said Will.
"It wants to stay here. I've killed enough living things. Even a filthy, stagnant pool might be better than being dead."
"But if it's in pain..."
"If it could tell us, we'd know. But since it can't, I'm not going to kill it. That would be considering our feelings, rather than the toad's."
They moved on. Before long, the changing sound their footsteps made told them that there was an openness nearby, although the mist was even thicker. Pantalaimon was a lemur, with the biggest eyes he could manage, clinging to Lyra's shoulder, pressing himself into her fog-pearled hair, peering all around and seeing no more than she did. And still he was trembling and trembling. Suddenly they all heard a little wave breaking. It was quiet, but it was very close by. The dragonflies returned with their riders to the children, and Pantalaimon crept into Lyra's breast as she and Will moved closer together, treading carefully along the slimy path. And then they were at the shore. The oily, scummy water lay still in front of them, an occasional ripple breaking languidly on the pebbles. The path turned to the left, and a little way along, more like a thickening of the mist than a solid object, a wooden jetty stood crazily out over the water. The piles were decayed and the planks were green with slime, and there was nothing else, nothing beyond it. The path ended where the jetty began, and where the jetty ended, the mist began. Lyra's death, having guided them there, bowed to her and stepped into the fog, vanishing before she could ask him what to do next.
"Listen,"
said Will. There was a slow, repetitive sound out on the invisible water, a creak of wood and a quiet, regular splash. Will put his hand on the knife at his belt and moved forward carefully onto the rotting planks. Lyra followed close behind. The dragonflies perched on the two weed-covered mooring posts, looking like heraldic guardians, and the children stood at the end of the jetty, pressing their open eyes against the mist, and having to brush their lashes free of the drops that settled on them. The only sound was that slow creak and splash that was getting closer and closer.
"Don't let's go,"
Pantalaimon whispered.
"Got to,"
Lyra whispered back. She looked at Will. His face was set hard and grim and eager. He wouldn't turn aside. And the Gallivespians, Tialis on Will's shoulder, Salmakia on Lyra's, were calm and watchful. The dragonfly's wings were pearled with mist, like cobwebs, and from time to time they'd beat them quickly to clear them, because the drops must make them heavy, Lyra thought. She hoped there would be food for them in the land of the dead. Then, suddenly, there was the boat. It was an ancient rowboat, battered, patched, rotting, and the figure rowing it was aged beyond age, huddled in a robe of sacking bound with string, crippled and bent, his bony hands crooked permanently around the oar handles, and his moist, pale eyes sunk deep among folds and wrinkles of grey skin. He let go of an oar and reached his crooked hand up to the iron ring set in the post at the corner of the jetty. With the other hand he moved the oar to bring the boat right up against the planks. There was no need to speak. Will got in first, and then Lyra came forward to step down, too. But the boatman held up his hand.
"Not him,"
he said.
"Not who?"
"Not him."
He extended a yellow-grey finger, pointing directly at Pantalaimon, whose red-brown, stoked form immediately became ermine white.
"But he is me."
"If you come, he must stay."
"But we can't. We die."
"Isn't that what you want?"
And then, for the first time, Lyra truly realized what she was doing. This was the real consequence. She stood aghast, trembling, and clutched her dear demon so tightly that he whimpered in pain.
"They..."
said Lyra helplessly, then stopped. It wasn't fair to point out that the other three didn't have to give anything up. Will was watching her anxiously. She looked all around, at the lake, at the jetty, at the rough path, the stagnant puddles, the dead and sodden bushes. Her Pan, alone here. How could he live without her? He was shaking inside her shirt, against her bare flesh, his fur needing her warmth. Impossible! Never!
He must stay here if you are to come.
The Lady Salmakia flicked the rein, and her dragonfly skimmed away from Lyra's shoulder to land on the gunwale of the boat, where Tialis joined her. They said something to the boatman. Lyra watched as a condemned prisoner watches the stir at the back of the courtroom that might be a messenger with a pardon. The boatman bent to listen and then shook his head.
No. If she comes, he has to stay.
That's not right. We don't have to leave part of ourselves behind. Why should Lyra?
No, but you do. It's her misfortune that she can see and talk to the part she must leave. You will not know until you are on the water, and then it will be too late. But you all have to leave that part of yourselves here. There is no passage to the land of the dead for such as him.
No, Lyra thought, and Pantalaimon thought with her. We didn't go through Bolvanger for this. No. How will we ever find each other again? And she looked back again at the foul and dismal shore, so bleak and blasted with disease and poison, and thought of her dear Pan waiting there alone, her heart's companion, watching her disappear into the mist, and she fell into a storm of weeping. Her passionate sobs didn't echo because the mist muffled them, but all along the shore, in innumerable ponds and shallows, in wretched broken tree stumps, the damaged creatures that lurked there heard her full-hearted cry and drew themselves a little closer to the ground, afraid of such passion.
"If he could come,"
cried Will, desperate to end her grief, but the boatman shook his head.
"He can come in the boat, but if he does, the boat stays here."
But how will she find him again?
I don't know.
When we leave, will we come back this way?
Leave?
We're going to come back. We're going to the land of the dead, and we are going to come back.
Not this way.
Then some other way, but we will.
I have taken millions, and none came back.
Then we shall be the first. We'll find our way out. And since we're going to do that, be kind, boatman. Be compassionate. Let her take her demon.
No.
He shook his ancient head.
It's not a rule you can break. It's a law, like this one.
He leaned over the side and cupped a handful of water and then tilted his hand so it ran out again.
The law that makes the water fall back into the lake. It's a law like that. I can't tilt my hand and make the water fly upward. No more can I take her demon to the land of the dead. Whether or not she comes, he must stay.
Lyra could see nothing. Her face was buried in Pantalaimon's cat fur. But Will saw Tialis dismount from his dragonfly and prepare to spring at the boatman, and he half agreed with the spy's intention. But the old man had seen him, and turned his ancient head to say,
How many ages do you think I've been ferrying people to the land of the dead? Do you think if anything could hurt me, it wouldn't have happened already? Do you think the people I take come with me gladly? They struggle and cry. They try to bribe me. They threaten and fight. Nothing works. You can't hurt me, sting as you will. Better comfort the child. She's coming. Take no notice of me.
Will could hardly watch. Lyra was doing the cruelest thing she had ever done. Hating herself, hating the deed, suffering for Pan and with Pan and because of Pan, trying to put him down on the cold path, disengaging his cat claws from her clothes, weeping, weeping. Will closed his ears. The sound was too unhappy to bear. Time after time she pushed her demon away, and still he cried and tried to cling. She could turn back. She could say, No, this is a bad idea, we mustn't do it. She could be true to the heart-deep, life-deep bond linking her to Pantalaimon. She could put that first. She could push the rest out of her mind. But she couldn't.
Pan, no one's done this before. But Will says we're coming back. And I swear, Pan, I love you. I swear we're coming back. I will. Take care, my dear. You'll be safe. We will come back. And if I have to spend every minute of my life finding you again, I will. I won't stop. I won't rest. I won't... Oh, Pan. Dear Pan. I've got to.
And she pushed him away, so that he crouched bitter and cold and frightened on the muddy ground. What animal he was now, Will could hardly tell. He seemed to be so young, a cub, a puppy, something helpless and beaten, a creature so sunk in misery that it was more misery than creature. His eyes never left Lyra's face, and Will could see her making herself not look away, not avoid the guilt, and he admired her honesty and her courage at the same time as he was wrenched with the shock of their parting. There were so many vivid currents of feeling between them that the very air felt electric to him. And Pantalaimon didn't ask why, because he knew. And he didn't ask whether Lyra loved Roger more than him, because he knew the true answer to that, too. And he knew that if he spoke, she wouldn't be able to resist. So the demon held himself quiet so as not to distress the human who was abandoning him. And now they were both pretending that it wouldn't hurt, it wouldn't be long before they were together again. It was all for the best. But Will knew that the little girl was tearing her heart out of her breast. Then she stepped down into the boat. She was so light that it barely rocked at all. She sat beside Will, and her eyes never left Pantalaimon, who stood trembling at the shore end of the jetty. But as the boatman let go of the iron ring and swung his oars out to pull the boat away, the little dog demon trotted helplessly out to the very end, his claws clicking softly on the soft planks, and stood watching, just watching, as the boat drew away and the jetty faded and vanished in the mist. Then Lyra gave a cry so passionate that even in that muffled, mist-hung world it raised an echo. But of course it wasn't an echo, it was the other part of her crying in turn from the land of the living as Lyra moved away into the land of the dead.
"My heart, Will!"
She clung to him, her wet face contorted with pain. And thus the prophecy that the master of Jordan College had made to the librarian, that Lyra would make a great betrayal and it would hurt her terribly, was fulfilled. But Will, too, found an agony building inside him, and through the pain he saw that the two Gallivespians, clinging together just as he and Lyra were doing, were moved by the same anguish. Part of it was physical. It felt as if an iron hand had gripped his heart and was pulling it out between his ribs, so that he pressed his hands to the place and vainly tried to hold it in. It was far deeper and far worse than the pain of losing his fingers. But it was mental, too. Something secret and private was being dragged into the open, where it had no wish to be. And Will was nearly overcome by a mixture of pain and shame and fear and self-reproach, because he himself had caused it. And it was worse than that. It was as if he'd said, "No, don't kill me, I'm frightened. Kill my mother instead. She doesn't matter, I don't love her." And as if she'd heard him say it, and pretended she hadn't so as to spare his feelings, and offered herself in his place anyway because of her love for him. He felt as bad as that. There was nothing worse to feel. So Will knew that all those things were part of having a demon, and that whatever his demon was, she, too, was left behind, with Pantalaimon, on that poisoned and desolate shore. The thought came to Will and Lyra at the same moment, and they exchanged a tear-filled glance. And for the second time in their lives, but not the last, each of them saw their own expression on the other's face. Only the boatman and the dragonflies seemed indifferent to the journey they were making. The great insects were fully alive and bright with beauty even in the clinging mist, shaking their filmy wings to dislodge the moisture. And the old man in his sacking robe leaned forward and back, bracing his bare feet against the slime-puddled floor. The journey lasted longer than Lyra wanted to measure. Though part of her was raw with anguish, imagining Pantalaimon abandoned on the shore, another part was adjusting to the pain, measuring her own strength, curious to see what would happen and where they would land. Will's arm was strong around her, but he, too, was looking ahead, trying to peer through the wet grey gloom and to hear anything other than the dank splash of the oars. And presently something did change. A cliff or an island lay ahead of them. They heard the enclosing of the sound before they saw the mist darken. The boatman pulled on one oar to turn the boat a little to the left.
"Where are we?"
said the voice of the Chevalier Tialis, small but strong as ever, though there was a harsh edge to it, as if he too had been suffering pain.
"Near the island," said the boatman. "Another 5 minutes,
will be at the landing stage.
What island?
Said Will. He found his own voice strained, too, so tight it hardly seemed his.
The gate to the land of the dead is on this island. Everyone comes here. Kings, queens, murderers, poets, children. Everyone comes this way, and none come back.
We shall come back.
The boatman said nothing, but his ancient eyes were full of pity. As they moved closer, they could see branches of cypress and yew hanging down low over the water, dark green, dense, and gloomy. The land rose steeply, and the trees grew so thickly that hardly a ferret could slip between them. And at that thought, Lyra gave a little half-hiccup, half-sob, for Pan would have shown her how well he could do it. But not now. Maybe not ever again.
Are we dead now?
Makes no difference. There's some that came here never believing they were dead. They insisted all the way that they were alive. It was a mistake. Someone would have to pay. Made no difference. There's others who longed to be dead when they were alive, poor souls. Lives full of pain or misery, killed themselves for a chance of a blessed rest, and found that nothing had changed except for the worse. And this time, there was no escape. You can't make yourself alive again. And there's been others, so frail and sickly, little infants sometimes, that they're scarcely born into the living before they come down to the dead. I've rowed this boat with a little crying baby on my lap many, many times, that never knew the difference between up there and down here. And old folk, too. The rich ones are the worst. Snarling and savage and cursing me, railing and screaming. What did I think I was? Hadn't they gathered and saved all the gold they could garner? Wouldn't I take some now to put them back ashore? They'd have the law on me. They had powerful friends. They knew the Pope and the King of this and the Duke of that. They were in a position to see I was punished and chastised. But they knew what the truth was in the end. The only position they were in was in my boat, going to the land of the dead. And as for those kings and popes, they'd be in here too in their turn, sooner than they wanted. I let him cry and rave. They can't hurt me. They fall silent in the end. So if you don't know whether you're dead or not, and the little girl swears blind she'll come out again to the living, I say nothing to contradict you. What you are, you'll know soon enough.
All the time he had been steadily rowing along the shore, and now he shipped the oars, slipping the handles down inside the boat and reaching out to his right for the first wooden post that rose out of the lake. He pulled the boat alongside the narrow wharf and held it still for them. Lyra didn't want to get out. As long as she was near the boat, then Pantalaimon would be able to think of her properly because that was how he last saw her. But when she moved away from it, he wouldn't know how to picture her anymore. So she hesitated, but the dragonflies flew up, and Will got out, pale and clutching his chest. So she had to as well.
Thank you,
she said to the boatman.
When you go back, if you see my demon, tell him I love him the best of everything in the land of the living or the dead, and I swear I'll come back to him, even if no one's ever done it before. I swear I will.
Yes, I'll tell him that, said the old boatman.
He pushed off and the sound of his slow oar strokes faded away in the mist. The Galavespians flew back, having gone a little way, and perched on the children's shoulders as before, she on Lyra, he on Will. So they stood, the travellers, at the edge of the land of the dead. Ahead of them there was nothing but mist, though they could see from the darkening of it that a great wall rose in front of them. Lyra shivered. She felt as if her skin had turned into lace and the damp and bitter air could flow in and out of her ribs, scaldingly cold on the raw wound where Pantalaimon had been. Still, she thought, Roger must have felt like that as he plunged down the mountainside, trying to cling to her desperate fingers. They stood still and listened. The only sound was an endless drip, drip, drip of water from the leaves. And as they looked up, they felt one or two drops splash coldly on their cheeks.
"Can't stay here,"
said Lyra. They moved off the wharf, keeping close together, and made their way to the wall. Gigantic stone blocks, green with ancient slime, rose higher into the mist than they could see. And now that they were closer, they could hear the sound of cries behind it, though whether they were human voices crying was impossible to tell. High, mournful shrieks and wails that hung in the air like the drifting filaments of a jellyfish, causing pain wherever they touched.
"There's a door,"
said Will. It was a battered wooden postern under a slab of stone. Before Will could lift his hand and open it, one of those high, harsh cries sounded very close by, jarring their ears and frightening them horribly. Immediately the Gallivespians darted into the air, the dragonflies like little war horses eager for battle. But the thing that flew down swept them aside with a brutal blow from her wing and then settled heavily on a ledge just above the children's heads. Tialis and Salmakia gathered themselves and soothed their shaken mounts. The thing was a great bird, the size of a vulture, with the face and breasts of a woman. Will had seen pictures of creatures like her, and the word harpy came to mind as soon as he saw her clearly. Her face was smooth and unwrinkled, but aged beyond even the age of the witches. She had seen thousands of years pass, and the cruelty and misery of all of them had formed the hateful expression on her features. But as the travellers saw her more clearly, she became even more repulsive. Her eye sockets were clotted with filthy slime, and the redness of her lips was caked and crusted as if she had vomited ancient blood again and again. Her matted, filthy black hair hung down to her shoulders. Her jagged claws gripped the stone fiercely. Her powerful dark wings were folded along her back, and a drift of putrescent stink wafted from her every time she moved. Will and Lyra, both of them sick and full of pain, tried to stand upright and face her.
"But you are alive,"
the harpy said, her harsh voice mocking them. Will found himself hating and fearing her more than any human being he had ever known.
"Who are you?"
said Lyra, who was just as repelled as Will. For answer, the harpy screamed. She opened her mouth and directed a jet of noise right in their faces, so that their heads rang and they nearly fell backwards. Will clutched at Lyra, and they both clung together as the scream turned into wild, mocking peals of laughter, which were answered by other harpy voices in the fog along the shore. The jeering, hate-filled sound reminded Will of the merciless cruelty of children in a playground. But there were no teachers here to regulate things, no one to appeal to, nowhere to hide. He set his hand on the knife at his belt and looked her in the eyes, though his head was ringing and the sheer power of her scream had made him dizzy.
"If you're trying to stop us, then you'd better be ready to fight as well as scream, because we're going through that door."
The harpy's sickening red mouth moved again, but this time it was to purse her lips into a mock kiss.
"Your mother is alone. We shall send her nightmares. We shall scream at her in her sleep."
Will didn't move, because out of the corner of his eye he could see the Lady Salmakia moving delicately along the branch where the harpy was perching. Her dragonfly, wings quivering, was being held by Tialis on the ground. And then two things happened. The lady leapt at the harpy and spun around to dig her spur deep into the creature's scaly leg, and Tialis launched the dragonfly upwards. In less than a second, Salmakia had spun away and leapt off the branch, directly onto the back of her electric blue steed, and up into the air. The effect on the harpy was immediate. Another scream shattered the silence, much louder than before, and she beat her dark wings so hard that Will and Lyra both felt the wind and staggered. But she clung to the stone with her claws, and her face was suffused with dark red anger, and her hair stood out from her head like a crest of serpents. Will tugged at Lyra's hand, and they both tried to run towards the door, but the harpy launched herself at them in a fury and only pulled up from the dive when Will turned, thrusting Lyra behind him and holding up the knife. The Gallivespians were on her at once, darting close at her face and then darting away again, unable to get in a blow but distracting her so that she beat her wings clumsily and half fell onto the ground.
"Tialis! Salmakia! Stop! Stop!"
The spies reined back their dragonflies and skimmed high over the children's heads. Other dark forms were clustering in the fog, and the jeering screams of 100 more harpies sounded from further along the shore. The first one was shaking her wings, shaking her hair, stretching each leg in turn and flexing her claws. She was unhurt, and that was what Lyra had noticed. The Gallivespians hovered and then dived back towards Lyra, who was holding out both hands for them to land on. Salmakia realized what Lyra had meant, and said to Tialis,
"She's right. We can't hurt her for some reason."
"Lady, what's your name?"
The harpy shook her wings wide, and the travelers nearly fainted from the hideous smells of corruption and decay that wafted from her.
"No name!"
"What do you want with us?"
"What can you give me?"
"We could tell you where we've been, and maybe you'd be interested. I don't know. We saw all kinds of strange things on the way here."
"Oh? And you're offering to tell me a story?"
"If you'd like."
"Maybe I would. And what then?"
"You might let us go in through that door and find the ghost we've come here to look for. I hope you would anyway, if you'd be so kind."
"Try, then."
And even in her sickness and pain, Lyra felt that she'd just been dealt the ace of trumps.
"Oh, be careful,"
whispered Salmakia. But Lyra's mind was already racing ahead through the story she'd told the night before, shaping and cutting and improving and adding, parents dead, family treasure, shipwreck, escape.
"Well,"
she said, settling into her storytelling frame of mind,
"it began when I was a baby, really. My father and mother were the Duke and Duchess of Abingdon, you see, and they were as rich as anything. My father was one of the king's advisers, and the king himself used to come and stay, oh, all the time. They'd go hunting in our forest. The house there, where I was born, it was the biggest house in the whole south of England. It was called..."
Without even a cry of warning, the harpy launched herself at Lyra, claws outstretched. Lyra just had time to duck, but still one of the claws caught her scalp and tore out a clump of hair.
"Liar! Liar! Liar!"
She flew around again, aiming directly for Lyra's face, but Will took out the knife and threw himself in the way. No Name swerved out of reach just in time, and Will hustled Lyra over towards the door because she was numb with shock and half-blinded by the blood running down her face. Where the Gallivespians were, Will had no idea, but the harpy was flying at them again and screaming in rage and hatred.
"Liar! Liar! Liar!"
And it sounded as if her voice were coming from everywhere, and the word echoed back from the great wall in the fog, muffled and changed, so that she seemed to be screaming Lyra's name, so that Lyra and Liar were one and the same thing. Will had Lyra pressed against his chest, with his shoulder curved over to protect her, and he felt her shaking and sobbing against him. But then he thrust the knife into the rotten wood of the door and cut out the lock with a quick slash of the blade. Then he and Lyra, with the spies beside them on their darting dragonflies, tumbled through into the realm of the ghosts, as the harpy's cry was doubled and redoubled by others on the foggy shore behind them. Chapter 22. The Whisperers.
Thick as autumnal leaves that strow the brooks in Vallombrosa, where the Etrurian shades high overarched embower. John Milton.
The first thing Will did was to make Lyra sit down, and then he took out the little pot of blood moss ointment and looked at the wound on her head. It was bleeding freely, as scalp wounds do, but it wasn't deep. He tore a strip off the edge of his shirt and mopped it clean, and spread some of the ointment over the gash, trying not to think of the filthy state of the claw that made it. Lyra's eyes were glazed, and she was ash pale.
"Lyra! Lyra!"
he said, and shook her gently.
"Come on now, we've got to move."
She gave a shudder and took a long, shaky breath, and her eyes focused on him, full of a wild despair.
"Will, I can't do it anymore. I can't do it. I can't tell lies. I thought it was so easy, but it didn't work. It's all I can do, and it doesn't work."
"It's not all you can do. You can read the alethiometer, can't you? Come on, let's see where we are. Let's look for Roger."
He helped her up, and for the first time they looked around at the land where the ghosts were. They found themselves on a great plain that extended far ahead into the mist. The light by which they saw was a dull self-luminescence that seemed to exist everywhere equally, so that there were no true shadows and no true light, and everything was the same dingy color. Standing on the floor of this huge space were adults and children, ghost people, so many that Lyra couldn't guess their number. At least, most of them were standing, though some were sitting and some lying down, listless or asleep. No one was moving about or running or playing, though many of them turned to look at these new arrivals with a fearful curiosity in their wide eyes.
Ghosts! This is where they all are. Everyone that's ever died.
No doubt it was because she didn't have Pantalaimon anymore, but she clung close to Will's arm, and he was glad she did. The Gallivespians had flown ahead, and he could see their bright little forms darting and skimming over the heads of the ghosts, who looked up and followed them with wonder. But the silence was immense and oppressive, and the grey light filled him with fear, and Lyra's warm presence beside him was the only thing that felt like life. Behind them, outside the wall, the screams of the harpies were still echoing up and down the shore. Some of the ghost people were looking up apprehensively, but more of them were staring at Will and Lyra, and then they began to crowd forward. Lyra shrank back. She didn't have the strength just yet to face them as she would have liked to do, and it was Will who had to speak first.
"Do you speak our language? Can you speak at all?"
Shivering and frightened and full of pain as he and Lyra were, they had more authority than the whole mass of the dead put together. These poor ghosts had little power of their own, and hearing Will's voice, the first clear voice that had sounded there in all the memory of the dead, many of them came forward, eager to respond. But they could only whisper. A faint, pale sound, no more than a soft breath, was all they could utter. And as they thrust forward, jostling and desperate, the Gallivespians flew down and darted to and fro in front of them, to prevent them from crowding too close. The ghost children looked up with a passionate longing, and Lyra knew at once why. They thought the dragonflies were demons. They were wishing with all their hearts that they could hold their own demons again.
"Oh, they ain't demons. And if my own demon was here, you could all stroke him and touch him, I promise."
And she held out her hands to the children. The adult ghosts hung back, listless or fearful, but the children all came thronging forward. They had as much substance as fog, poor things, and Lyra's hands passed through and through them, as did Will's. They crammed forward, light and lifeless, to warm themselves at the flowing blood and the strong beating hearts of the two travellers, and both Will and Lyra felt a succession of cold, delicate brushing sensations as the ghosts passed through their bodies, warming themselves on the way. The two living children felt that little by little they were becoming dead too. They hadn't got an infinite amount of life and warmth to give, and they were so cold already, and the endless crowds pressing forward looked as if they were never going to stop. Finally, Lyra had to plead with them to hold back. She held up her hands and said,
"Please, we wish we could touch you all, but we came down here to look for someone, and I need you to tell me where he is and how to find him. Oh, Will,"
she said, leaning her head to his,
"I wish I knew what to do."
The ghosts were fascinated by the blood on Lyra's forehead. It glowed as brightly as a holly berry in the dimness, and several of them had brushed through it, longing for the contact with something so vibrantly alive. One ghost girl, who when she was alive must have been about 9 or 10, reached up shyly to try and touch it, and then shrank back in fear. But Lyra said,
"Don't be afraid. We ain't come here to hurt you. Speak to us, if you can."
The ghost girl spoke, but in her thin, pale voice it was only a whisper.
"Did the harpies do that? Did they try and hurt you?"
"Yeah,"
said Lyra.
"But if that's all they can do, I ain't worried about them."
"Oh, it isn't... Oh, they do worse."
"What? What do they do?"
But they were reluctant to tell her. They shook their heads and kept silent, until one boy said,
It ain't so bad for them that's been here hundreds of years, because you get tired after all.